Thanks for joining us at the Canadian Breakpoint, a Canadian infectious diseases podcast by Canadian infectious diseases physicians. I'm Summer Stewart, back with Dr. Rupina Purewal, pediatric infectious diseases physician in Saskatoon. For this episode, we welcome Dr. Jason Kinderchuk from University of Manitoba to discuss monkeypox. Dr. Purewal.
All right. Welcome, everyone, to another episode of our podcast, The Canadian Breakpoint. Today, we have a very special guest with us, Dr. Kinderchuk, who is an associate professor and Canada Research Chair in Emerging Virus Pathogenesis in the Department of Medical Microbiology and Infectious Diseases, and cross-appointed in the Department of Internal Medicine and the Manitoba Center for Proteomics and Systems Biology, the University of Manitoba. His work focuses on viruses that pose the greatest threat to global health, including Ebola virus, orthopoxviruses, coronaviruses, and influenza viruses. His research program centers on the circulation, transmission, and pathogenesis of emerging viruses. Past and present findings from these investigations will help inform emerging virus therapeutic treatment strategies, outbreak prediction, and preparedness efforts with impacts on both human and animal health. Dr. Kinderchuk leads multiple nationally funded emerging infectious disease research investigations, including One Health emerging zoonotic virus surveillance activities in Canada and Africa. These include as a director for the International Mpox Response Consortium, co-lead for Pillar 2 of the Coronavirus Variants Rapid Response Network, and ongoing investigations on the long-term impacts of Ebola virus infection in disease survivors in West Africa. Thank you so much, Dr. Kinderchuk, for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Perfect. And so today we're going to talk about a very important topic, and that's monkeypox. For our listeners out there, so just so you're aware, there's pharmacists, physicians, nurses, and many different other healthcare professionals that tune into the podcast. And so I thought monkeypox was, you know, it's an episode I've been wanting to do for a while. And I think with, you know, the recent WHO global health emergency that was reported just this past week, I think this is a pressing topic, and a lot of us are interested in kind of hearing more about this.
Absolutely.
All right. So I think because we have so many different types of listeners, I think it would be really important to kind of just start with a background and really, what is this viral disease? And, you know, what is monkeypox? How does someone get this virus? And what should we think about? And when should we be thinking about it?
Yeah, it's a great question, right? And I think for this, kind of have to go back a little bit to, you know, when monkeypox virus was first identified. It's actually first identified in 1958, actually at really amongst captive non-human primates. We didn't see any human infections diagnosed until 1970. That was in Democratic Republic of the Congo. But if we think about this from a historic perspective, that's probably not that surprising, because there was this kind of other little thing going on in the world called smallpox that unfortunately had a very, very similar clinical presentation. So following the eradication of smallpox and obviously the cessation of the global vaccination program, what we've seen really from 1980 onwards is this kind of steady increase in monkeypox virus infections across endemic regions of Africa. That's kind of been divided based on geography. Cameroon is the central point. Cameroon is the only place where we find both clade 1 and clade 2 monkeypox virus co-circulating. Anywhere west of Cameroon, we only find clade 2 monkeypox virus being endemic. And to the east of there is clade 1 monkeypox virus. Things get a little bit complicated when we start talking about, you know, how they differ from one another. Historically, clade 1 monkeypox virus has been associated with more severe disease, but we have to appreciate that that's also based on really kind of limited data for clade 2 infections, really up until the reemergence in Nigeria in 2017, and then the subsequent movement out of Nigeria to the global north in 2022, and the obvious epidemic expansion. So historically, when we look at the disease, pre-2022, the disease looked really like a composite of human smallpox. Really the difference being the lymphadenopathy that's seen in monkeypox virus infections, but you still saw the fully disseminated disease, really the face, arms, legs, hands, and feet being the areas where you saw the most lesions. And the lesions tended to be all in the same stage of development. So whether it was on the face or on the feet. everything seemed to be, you know, fairly symmetrical in that regard. Then 2022 hits, and we start seeing atypical presentation. So what we saw in 2022, virus moved out into Europe first, and then moved globally across more than 100 countries. Those infections were associated with dense sexual networks. That was something we hadn't really seen previously. And there was this high overrepresentation amongst men and those that identify as gay, bisexual, or other men who have sex with men. The presentation tended to actually look a lot like other sexually transmitted or bloodborne infections. So a lot of lesions within the groin, a lot of rectal lesions in men, isolated lesions in other regions of the body, but not the fully disseminated disease that we kind of, you know, typically had seen historically. And the lesions were not all in the same stage of development. That has complicated the picture because now you can't just kind of, you know, do a clinical diagnosis based on what the disease looks like. So we still have virus moving through the global community. Clade 2B monkeypox virus continues to circulate. We've seen clusters in Canada since 2022 onwards. Mm-hmm. But then we saw, you know, really the kind of tipping point in DRC starting in 2023 with this, you know, massive increase in infections. And that's kind of led to where we are today with the public health emergency.
Okay. And in terms of the signs and the symptoms that people are seeing, is this kind of widespread depending on, like, does it matter the age group? So younger, like, children are seeing kind of similar presentation as the adults?
It really, so far, it really depends on the different clades, right? And mm-hmm. again, you know, we almost have to kind of take clade 2 and kind of separate, like, pre-2022 and almost kind of pre-2017 versus post kind of Nigeria reemergence and global reemergence. Prior to 2017, very few cases of clade 2 had ever been reported. We saw a small outbreak in the U.S. in 2003. Some kids were infected. That was all through zoonotic transmission. We did see a couple cases of severe disease there, but predominantly we didn't see a lot of fatal infections. 2017, Nigeria, everything starts to kind of skew a little bit older in terms of the average age group where we're seeing the infections. And then, of course, in 2022 onwards, with the global outbreak, most infections, you know, in kind of the 20 to 40 age group, and again, skewing towards men, very few infections in women and in kids. Mm-hmm. In DRC, very, very different, right? So what we're seeing right now and really the last 20 months, even with this kind of, you know, rapid increase in cases, the kind of demographics for severe disease and infections have not really changed. So in DRC, vast majority of infections still are based off of zoonotic contacts, mostly we think contact with rodents. Those infections tend to skew towards children under the age of 15. That tends to be the group that is in contact with those animals. And we tend to see the highest mortality and morbidity amongst mm-hmm. those age groups. Now, we also shift a little bit because mid-2023, we picked up, and I say weeks, it includes certainly at the forefront of this, our Congolese colleagues and others from the U.S. and Europe. We picked up cases of a cluster of cases that were related to sexual contact in Kwango province. Very, you know, an N of 5, very small, still skewing towards kind of an older age group, but we saw men and women included in that. Since that time point, really in South Kivu province, we've seen again this, you know, kind of this massive inflection of cases in an area mm-hmm. that historically had not seen much. Those cases over, you know, highly overrepresented among sex workers and dense sexual networks, but even seemingly evenly spread between men and women so far. We're not seeing much in terms of infections in kids, but that may change over time. We've seen movement of that particular type of monkeypox virus, what we've now termed clade 1B, more sustained human-to-human transmission. That virus has moved into North Kivu, and we've seen cases in internal displacement camps, and that's included in, at least in our case investigations, in a few children. Mm-hmm. No severe disease so far, but, you know, we're still, I think, at the early stages. So it's complicated. We're trying to kind of follow the epi as closely as we can.
Okay. Yeah. So definitely different routes of transmission, and that's been evolving as well. Yeah. Has it been different for host like host dependent as well. So if somebody is immunocompromised, do they have more severe disease or they pick up the virus quicker?
Yeah. So what we saw in again in 2022, you know, really kind of opened our eyes, I think, a little bit to what monkeypox virus infections could look like. In 2022, you know, there's a few global case series that looked at the risks for infection. There was an increased risk if somebody was HIV positive or a person living with HIV, same thing with other STIs. We didn't know much at that point as to whether or not there was an increased risk for severity of disease. We've now seen with HIV that certainly people that have uncontrolled HIV can have a more severe course of mpox than what we see in individuals who have control disease or otherwise are, you know, have kind of a normal immune response. But it's complicated. In Congo, we don't know. It certainly is kind of top of mind for us. There's not a lot of STI testing. HIV rates tend to actually be quite low in Congo. So that maybe has helped us a little bit, but we're hoping to deploy STI testing, certainly in the South Kivu and some of the surrounding areas over the next few months.
All right. And then you talked a little bit about the strain, the common strains that are currently circulating. Yeah. And so what is the predominant strain right now that you're seeing?
Yeah. So, you know, again, since it's Democratic Republic of the Congo, clade one monkeypox virus is the only type of monkeypox virus we've seen there before. We've now subdivided that into clade 1A and clade 1B. Clade 1A is the virus that's associated with zoonotic infections. Those are still making up the vast majority of the cases we see in DRC at the moment. Clade 1B, we're seeing certainly in South Kivu, starting to pick up in a few other areas now. That is associated with more sustained human-to-human transmission with no real zoonotic link. So we don't know a lot about clade 1B yet in terms of severity, number of factors we have to consider there, but we do know that it's certainly moving between people far easier. We think still through close contact and potentially with contaminated surfaces and, you know, in shared materials or, you know, bedding and clothing, especially if somebody has lesional disease. Right. But we haven't seen much in terms of changes in terms of things like, you know, a big respiratory component that's being included. But zoonotic infections, certainly far and away, are still driving the current outbreak.
And then in terms of, obviously, I think everybody is worried when they see a case like this. And so I guess we can divide it up into things because we can talk about prevention separately. And then when you do see a case, what do you do in terms of therapeutic management? So can you talk a little bit about how we can prevent and what kind of strategies are out there right now?
Yeah, you know, the infection prevention control piece is something certainly I've been involved in and many others have been involved in since 2022. One of the things that I think we appreciate very quickly is certainly that kind of risk for broader airborne transmission. We haven't seen any epi that's suggestive of that. But historically, we've been able to gain a lot of knowledge, certainly from endemic regions of Africa. So really the greatest risk for transmission we still see is that close extended contact, primarily through those that are providing care, whether they're healthcare workers or family members, whether they're sharing a bed, whether they're sharing clothing or bedding that is not being laundered. And we've seen the potential for transmission through things like sponges or cleaning materials. We've been working with a few groups, providing some guidance on looking at different disinfectants that are being used kind of in different areas of the world. The kind of good news is the majority of what we would assume continues to be the case. You know, bleach tends to work really well. Most good, antiviral disinfectants work very well. Soap and water work very well. A big piece of this is trying to ensure that anybody that has lesional disease, that things that they are in contact with or bedding or clothing are getting laundered, and that the people that are, you know, basically in contact with those things, either they're also monitoring their symptoms and or also using personal protective equipment.
Okay. Yeah. So very similar to other kind of viral diseases, we kind of encourage hand washing and your basic hygiene and laundering.
Absolutely. Our concern, I think, right now with DRC, I mean, there's a big focus on certainly the sustained human-to-human transmission piece for good reason. But there's also a big piece of this, which is, listen, we know where really kind of the root of many of these infections are, and it's that zoonotic contact. there's a big piece of this which I think is still, you know, kind of embedded in this idea of community engagement and trying to understand where infection prevention control practices can be implemented within communities that's done in a respectful and transparent manner in a way that doesn't impede people's ability to still hunt or to still, you know, be able to consume wild game.
And then once you have somebody who has a condition like this, who's contracted the virus, they have symptoms, they have signs, and you're considering, you know, thinking about, first, I guess we should talk about diagnostics, because if I'm an ER physician, or oftentimes as an infectious disease specialist, we'll get phone calls what to send off. So what, if I see a patient like this, what do I send off?
Yeah, so the easiest thing really is lesional swabs. OP swabs tend to work fairly well as well. There have been some studies that have looked at kind of longitudinal viremia in patients. Those, I think, for the most part, have suggested there's not a really strong viremic component, at least in the majority of cases. So I think, you know, we're still kind of focused on lesional swabs. PCR by far and away is the method that still continues to be tried and true. There's been some changes, though, because as we've seen kind of the emergence of, you know, clade 2B coming out as a subclade out of clade 2, and now clade 1B is a subclade of clade 1, we've also had to look at primers and whether or not those primers are still picking up the virus that we assume that they're recognizing. So for clade 1B, one of the things that we have seen recently has been that the kind of traditional primers that would be used normally for clade 1 infections, there's actually a deletion in clade 1B, and those primers could potentially give a false negative. Colleagues in Europe have already reported primer sets that appear to recognize clade 1B very, very well. But we also know that kind of like the overall kind of orthopox virus kind of centric primers work very, very well. They just don't give you that clade distinction, right? So PCR still works. We do a lot of sequencing. There's certainly something to be said about looking for antigens to try and identify if people have been previously exposed. We have done quite a bit of sero surveillance in this realm. The difficulty is pox viruses have very close antigenic similarities. It's why we use Vaccinia for eradicating smallpox, and we use it now for the mpox vaccine. That cross-reactivity somewhat precludes our ability to go in and say, okay, have you been exposed to monkeypox virus or cowpox virus or, you know, some other unknown human orthopox virus? That being said, in many areas that are endemic, we have a pretty good idea of what's circulating. And certainly if there's an outbreak situation, you can start to distinguish. There's questions about if somebody's been vaccinated for smallpox, what does cross-reactivity look like? But really, if we use kind of 1980 as that tipping point for people that were or weren't vaccinated, you can start kind of surmise what's going on based on that.
That's fair. And then are most centers, do they have the PCR testing, or is this kind of sent to National Microlab in Canada?
It's a good question. So certainly for clade 2 right now, like Cepheid has their, like the gene expert is, you know, certainly widely being used for clade 2. That I think continues to be the case. For clade 1B, there's certainly been some questions about how we're going to be able to test for this and really to try and distinguish clade 1B from clade 2B. The using, you know, kind of orthopox virus centric primers, you're still able to pick it up and say, okay, yeah, it's PCR positive, it's monkeypox virus, but we don't know which clade. For clade 1B, the issue that we have is this is a fairly recent development for the identification in Congo. So there's a lot of people that have been asking about access to nucleic acid to be able to validate tests within their own laboratories. And that's, you know, not only in Canada, but certainly, you know, well beyond and into many different places across the globe. That's going to be a big piece, I think, is that validation part. Likely, you know, we're always a little bit behind with sharing materials globally, unfortunately. I think now, given the public health emergencies, that's going to be a big piece. But the confidence comes out of that the primer sets that have been reported so far that have been in use through Congo and in other regions.
Okay. And then in terms of treatment, so are there antivirals out there, or this is mainly supportive management currently?
No, for clade 2 infections, TPOXX worked very, very well. Tecovirimat, ST246, I kind of have gone through every iteration of the naming at this point, worked very, very well, right? And certainly in the US and Canada, you know, that was kind of the, you know, the antiviral that people were moving towards to try and reduce the impact of these infections. There's been an issue though that's come up in Congo, which is a very recent clinical trial for Tecovirimat on the ground failed. It didn't show any added benefit. The reality though is that, you know, and it's unfortunate, there's probably a number of reasons why that trial, you know, may have, you know, been limited in its potential to be able to be successful. But a big piece that came out of that was you reduce the overall mortality just with providing good supportive care. And I think to me, that's a really important piece of this, which is, and for countries that have been scrambling for TPOXX, certainly in 2022, maybe, you know, looking to do that for 2024, Clade 1B, we don't think it works, but if you provide good supportive care, you reduce certainly the mortality. I think the bigger kind of piece of all of that though is saying in the areas where we see endemic disease, one of the things that we can do to immediately reduce the impact is be able to provide extra assistance for being able to give supportive care on the ground. So I think that's an important piece. Vaccination still works well. We have no reason to think the MVA, Bavarian Nordic vaccine, would not provide cross protection against Clade 1. It's still a vaccinia-based vaccine. So I don't think we have any concerns that way. A big part is still trying to get vaccines to really the kind of the hot spots of the world where we see circulation, and that continues to be an issue.
And so, yeah, so I would say, and I've had a couple of questions from physicians and colleagues and patients, you know, is it worthwhile like for them to get vaccinated, or is it something only limited to if they're traveling to these endemic areas?
You know, even through travel, it's, you know, I don't know as if there's a travel-based vaccination program that's available. That, again, that may change because of the public health emergency. You know, my lab and myself have been vaccinated because we obviously work with samples as well as with vaccinia virus and other pox viruses. I was vaccinated, you know, ages ago for ACAM 2000 or with ACAM 2000. The public availability is still pretty limited, right?
Yeah.
We had lots of stocks and stockpiles of ACAM 2000, but that was contraindicated for, you know, certainly for very specific groups. The JYNNEOS or MVA BN vaccine, we don't have nearly the stockpile that we did. So there's still basically the push to try and get that vaccine to those populations where there is an increased risk for infection, close contacts of patients that have suspected or confirmed cases. That's still the focus, but as well kind of appreciating that we need to get vaccine into certainly into Congo and probably now into Burundi and surrounding areas very, very quickly. So I think if we start seeing an influx in cases, whether Clade 2 or Clade 1 driven in Canada, there's going to be a need to ensure that healthcare workers are vaccinated. But there's the other piece too, which is good infection prevention control also is very, very good at reducing those infections. So, you know, we just have to kind of take it at face value.
Right. Okay. And so kind of the idea being prevention right now, and if somebody does have the illness, to be, you know, to be cautious to not be around others, especially those that are immune compromised, kind of similar to what we would say with any other viral infections.
100%, right? And we know, the thing is, we know that the routes of transmission predominantly, right? The, you know, mucosal membranes are going to be key in ensuring that we don't have any open wounds or abrasions. Like, those kinds of things continue to be important. And I think we go back to the idea of when people are vaccinating, people, certainly old school ACAM 2000 or even way back with Dryvax, it was about those preventative measures, trying to remove the risk for exposure.
Right. And so recently with WHO declaring this public health and global health emergency, and so how is the situation evolving, and appreciating that things are changing daily, I'm sure.
Yeah. I mean, the situation on the ground in Congo, you know, through certainly through the work that we're doing, I don't think that the situation has necessarily changed. Certainly, you know, we're looking at from 2023 to now around 30,000 suspected cases. We've seen movement of virus really to 25 to 26 provinces now with local transmission. It continues to be widespread, and we're not seeing any indication that things are starting to ramp down, right? So that continues to be a big concern for us. Probably as concerning of an issue though is really the movement into Burundi and some of the surrounding regions. Burundi in particular, because of the limited resources that are available in country, from a healthcare standpoint and just an overall standpoint, concerns about the increased circulation that we're now seeing there. You know, Uganda and Rwanda, we've seen cases. Kenya, we've seen cases. Those seem to be pretty controlled so far. That's assuming that people are feeling comfortable with self-reporting. But I think for us, that the focus right now is really what's going on in Congo, what's going on in Burundi. We've seen introduction, or at least the kind of the indication of cases that have been identified globally. So we've seen a case in Sweden. We've now seen a case in Thailand. That's not that surprising, right? Where people are still traveling, people are still, you know, still in a globalized community. We're likely going to see those cases continue to be identified. The bigger piece to me is going to be what happens afterwards. Do you see any additional signs of community transmission or broader transmission within those local populations? Or, you know, did you get good testing and contact tracing out and you don't see any local spread? So that I think continues to be important for developments. The other piece is we've seen, you know, really the kind of discussion about getting vaccines on the ground in Congo go from being a few months down the road to now kind of like within the next couple of weeks, there will be vaccine. Yeah. Don't know much about the deployment strategy yet, what that's going to look like, which groups are going to be kind of the focal groups for that first round. But certainly we're there and others are there to help support where we can and certainly to try to, you know, get some clinical information out as quick as possible where and when we can.
Okay. Seems like a very pressing situation, but, you know, things are in the works and hopefully, you know, we don't see more spread in circulating virus, because obviously we know what with the previous kind of virus activities we've seen over the last few years, we know that things can change really quickly. So in terms of Canada or other countries, what are they doing in terms of like mitigating risks or surveillance for disease surveillance locally too?
You know, I think one of the big pieces that, you know, that has, you know, maybe not gotten as much press as it's needed to over the last bit is we have this pressing situation in Central Africa. There's been a bigger question about, okay, well, what happens now if clade 1 moves more broadly and especially clade 1B? The thing that I think we need to appreciate is, you know, 2 years out from 2022, to appreciate that, listen, our surveillance networks, our testing and tracing networks, the knowledge base in our, you know, healthcare workers and as well, even within communities you know, community advocacy groups, all that has increased to a much higher level than it was pre-2022. So I think we're in a very good place for identifying cases. We continue to see, you know, cases being identified in Ontario, a little bit of a surge, you know, kind of coming through this summer. Same thing with other regions of the world, not approaching anything what we saw in 2022, but it should be a reminder that like clade 2 virus didn't disappear. It's still circulating globally. It's still circulating here within Canada. It's just at a very, very low level. So I think we're doing very, very good in terms of our surveillance. We now have to add the piece in about clade 1B recognition, but we're in a place where we should be able to identify those cases very, very quickly.
That's really good to hear. And so in terms of resources, because I think that's also important for healthcare professionals across the board, also sometimes just general public, you know, asking questions. And so where can people find, I mean, like obviously CDC has always been a really good resource, but are there other certain areas that we should be looking?
There are. I mean, I you know, I don't want to, you kind of shine a spotlight on work that I've done because I've sat on panels with far smarter people than myself to run some of this. WHO a couple of years ago had a guideline development group for clinical management, infection prevention control. That's freely available through WHO for MPOX. I think that still, you know, largely applies to everything that we're seeing now. WHO just recently updated all their information on infection prevention control, their descriptions of MPOX. Those resources are so good. And of course, Health Canada and Public Health Agency of Canada continue to provide information as well. And of course, there are research groups that are doing work in this area. Mm-hmm. You know, all of us have a lot of information as well, but I think going to those kind of big sources, European Centers for Disease Control, US CDC, WHO, and Health Canada are major resources.
That's really helpful because I think a lot of people will be starting to see more questions come through, and that's kind of natural. That happens clinically as well. You know, we always think about what's happening, what's circulating, and I think awareness is important. And so that's why we're talking about this today, because I think most of us should have some base knowledge on monkeypox, and you've given us some really good information today. So in terms of kind of summarizing or some key points that you'd want the public or healthcare professionals to really take away from today's episode, what would you kind of summarize in terms of that?
Yeah, I think a big piece of this is right now that the global risk for clade one introduction continues to be quite low. I think also appreciating that, you know, things can change. We know that that happened with clade two, but we're in a different place than we were in 2022. We have good surveillance networks. We have, you know, good sharing of data and testing protocols. I think that piece allowed us to be able to move forward. The kind of piece that I think is at the heart of this, though, is if we want to reduce the risk globally, we've got to reduce the risk locally, which still gets back to the need to not only get things contained in DRC, but also to look at other endemic areas of Africa and say, okay, we need to get vaccination programs up. We need to get surveillance programs sustained, and as well go back to this piece about healthcare infrastructure, and certainly the need to be able to harmonize data reporting globally right now for MPOC, so we all have a good impression of what we're looking for. I think it's going to be, you know, a key area.
Yeah. And then just on a note that I actually forgot to ask was in terms of reporting. So if physicians or anybody is seeing cases, are these then, like, I mean, through the lab, we're definitely reporting to public health, like local public health authorities. Is there something that a physician should be doing in terms of any surveillance network that they should be entering their data into if they see a case?
Not that I've seen so far, right? And listen, that can just be my naivety for what's available in Canada. In DRC, we've got WHO has their centralized system for us to be able to report and upload data continually into. So we've been working on that. And certainly most of those countries have good centralized systems for entering in national data. It can be a little bit slow at times, but we continue to do that on the ground as well. And then, of course, Africa CDC is obviously taking a much bigger role in this with trying to ensure that there's good data reporting, data management, and as well sharing of information globally.
Okay, that's great. So definitely, I think everybody's on top of it. And it's good to hear a little bit more, you know, about monkeypox and have a bit more background. So I've learned a lot for sure. And I always inform my listeners that this is an informational podcast and things do evolve. And over time, you know, even prevention or treatment options may change. So currently, this is the situation with monkeypox and what we know about it right now. So I'm sure our listeners will take a lot back from this episode. And thank you, Dr. Kinderchuk, for being here today on our podcast and providing us with such great information.
That was an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks. Take care.
Thank you, Dr. Kinderchuk, for joining us today. Have an episode suggestion? Email thecanadianbreakpoint@gmail.com and be sure to follow us on X @CABreakpoint for updates. See you again soon at the Canadian Breakpoint.